everybody, welcome to the Highlight Show. This is a show within our show where we sit down and talk to people doing really cool stuff. It could be someone starting a restaurant, it could be a youth group, it could be somebody who has just gone through something hard and has a really cool story to tell. We sit down with them, we pick their brains, and we glean what life lessons we can learn from their journey. Give it a listen. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. We're here with, it's not a pastor role, right? Like,
no, not yet. I'm on a path to it.
Okay, mm-hmm. So your name is Jim. Let's start there, so everybody's got that. Why don't you introduce yourself? Because I obviously don't have a good, like I know you're a director of operations, right?
Yep.
And so, like, what is it for the church that me and my family attend, Copper Hills? Why don't you give us a quick introduction to yourself and kind of what you're doing as a director of operations for a church?
So actually the formal title is Executive Director of Copper Hills.
Okay.
So I have responsibility for finance, HR, in the facility. So I've been here for 3 years, and it has been an adventure, to say the least.
Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah. Okay, so that's kind of the general manager of the church, huh?
Yeah, everything where business intersects the church operations, that's what I'm responsible for.
Okay.
My informal role is to support the team, support the staff that's here, and really allow them to serve the church family. So I look at it as my role is to pastor our team so they can share their gifts and work with the church family in their various pastoral and staff roles.
I like that a lot. It's because I like background roles. Like, there's the unsung heroes, you know, it's like garbage men. Like you don't appreciate a garbage man unless he doesn't show up for work.
Right.
Right. And then you'd start to pile up and you'd be like, oh my goodness, like I rely on this so much for my own ability to do what I do that I didn't, you know, it's so important. The infrastructure, for lack of a better word, it's not sexy at all.
Like, no.
It is behind the scenes, but it's so critical.
So Brandon, I call it sausage making. So we have obviously our lead pastor, Brad, you know, he's our first chair leader. We've got Pastor Paul and Pastor Kevin that oversee spiritual formation for our adults and spiritual formation for our kids. But there's just something that has to run, and that's what my team does. And I call it the sausage making of the church.
That's fantastic.
And as a result, we're second chair leaders, and that's where I actually am the most comfortable. I don't seek the limelight. I have enough visibility in my role, but you will very rarely see me on stage. I don't seek that out.
Right.
I'm just very content and happy, and this is my calling, is to use those gifts and, humbly serve.
I like that. I used to joke in my corporate job that I was the number two that all the managers wanted, right? Because I don't brag. I don't want the limelight. I just like doing a good job. And so like my managers were always like, yeah, let's get this guy. So because they would get promoted and I'm just like, see ya. Like I'm good. Like, and so that makes a lot of sense to me. I enjoy that. So are you originally from Phoenix? So, I'm confused here. Like I know you're a Seahawks fan.
Yes.
You know, but I'm also looking at the water bottle, which is a very Phoenix-based, like I was like super excited about the water bottle, but I was like, I'm conflicted deeply here. Are you from Arizona or are you from?
Born and raised.
Really?
Born and raised. So the Seahawk piece is very easy. The Cardinals had not moved here. My name's Jim.
Yep.
I'm left-handed. My cousin played professional football for the New York Giants. After he was cut, I was looking for a team. And I didn't like any of the West Coast teams. I didn't like Dallas. I didn't like L.A., San Diego. Jim Zorn was running around, throwing the ball left-handed. I thought the bird on the helmet was cool. I became a fan. That was 1980. Cardinals moved here in 88. They were cheap. They were not successful. Seahawks were doing okay, and I just stuck with them. So I was a Cardinals season ticket holder for years. I love all of the Arizona sports teams, but
That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not going to lie, because I have a Denver Broncos streak to me because my dad liked John Elway growing up, and the Cardinals have never been good enough to, like, really, like, maybe for, like, a couple of years, but then you're like, but I need something for those, you know, 10-year periods when they're not good. Yeah. I need somebody to watch. So, okay, that makes sense. So,
and I'm a character guy. So Zorn, very deep Christian, very deep in his faith. Our first Hall of Famer, Steve Largent, very deep in his faith. So it wasn't so much the team, though I love the team. It's also about the character of the guys.
I like that. Okay. All right. Well, it's fun to meet another Phoenician because there's not a lot of us that are born and raised here. Like almost.
I think there's 8 of us now.
Yeah, I know. It's... Oh, that's sad. It's funny because it's true and a little sad, but it is what it is. Yep. You know, like you can't stop it. So a little bit about you're at a church. Were you born and raised in the church? Like, did you grow up in the faith, or is that something that you came to at a later time?
I grew up in the faith, but it was the Catholic faith.
Okay.
So I went to Sunday school, catechism classes. My mom's side of the family was very involved in the Catholic faith. My dad, Baptist, but it was more of an obligation to go on Sunday. So our family kind of split apart. My sisters and I would go with mom, and my dad would just not go.
Okay.
So as a kid, until about age 16, that's what I did. I just went to Sunday Mass. When we were over at family in California, we'd go to daily Mass when we visited them, but that was the extent of it. So as a result, I kind of saw religion as a set of rules, confession, kind of a behavior set, to be very honest with you. So.
Yep, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting mix, like, 'cause I've spent a lot of time in Catholic and Baptist realms, and those are two that don't see eye to eye.
No.
You know, there's a lot of room for conversation, but those are like the two that they don't really want to sit at the table with each other very often.
So. No, and that was the thing that I struggled with is that, okay, is what does this look like? How does this become relational? So unfortunately, through my 20s and into my 30s, it was really more of a behavior piece. Okay. How do I try to be a good guy? Yeah. I became a father at 25. I felt that it was important to take the kids to church, raise them in the church. So we decided to go to non-denominational churches, which then just led to even candidly more confusion. Now it's a little bit more, less about behavior, less about the quote unquote goodness of my character. And now more about, well, I'm forgiven. So does that mean I have, what does that mean for me? What does that look like? So as my faith journey progressed into my 30s, it was still, I want to be a good guy, but I know when I mess up, I'm forgiven. But it was really kind of at that point, I'm a young father. I'm forgiven, but I have this young family I need to take care of.
Yeah.
So it was shifted from a behavioral mindset to more of a protection and provision mindset.
Yeah. Preaching God, to the choir right now. I understand this story. Yeah.
Yeah. God will protect us if we're faithful, if we do certain things, if we believe certain things. But it wasn't an active relationship with him. And then the provisional side will be there as long as I work hard, as long as I give back. Maybe that's financially, maybe that's time, maybe that's skill set. So, you know, I'm sitting there getting into my 40s now, just kind of wondering what this is all about. Yeah. What is it that I really believe? And that was really, it wasn't until 45 that I really kind of jumped into faith.
Wow.
And spent some real time trying to reflect in on what this really meant. So I read the Bible, but I would read the Bible based on my mood, based on my emotional need, based on where I thought God was leading me, where I thought Jesus was leading me, not necessarily based on trying to understand him, the covenant relationship between him and I, but then also what it looked like to actually have a relationship with him.
Yeah, that debt and credit kind of faith is hard because, like, I understand that where it's like, I got to check all these boxes because, like, I don't want to get punished, and then my family, then there, you know, and so you almost, the tough questions, the hard questions, and the deep work feel like doubt. And sometimes it feels like if you doubt, then that's a lack of faith, and then God is not going to bless you, or like you're going to lose that protection, you're going to lose those things. And so you're like, I can't even wrestle with the doubt because I can't risk it for these other people that rely on me type of a thing. And so that kind of debt and credit relationship with God is very limited. Like it doesn't come from a bad place, you know, because I think from a dad's position to care for their family, like it's pretty true that dads will do whatever it takes, you know, and that's what makes them so important. But it makes it hard for, and I'm listening and I'm just like, man, that is my story. Cause I'm also like, I'm coming into 40 here before too long and it's not far off. Like I'm just now probably in like the last year, 2 years, it starts to change and you start to realize like, oh, it doesn't work that way. Like it's not, there is no debt and there is no credit anymore. It's just growth and relationship. And it's hard to wrap your hands around because you want to do something,
right?
You know,
right.
And that's so hard. So what was there something that kind of flipped the switch, or was there an event, or was it just the gradual change into like, how did you make that switch from say debt to credit into relationship or covenant and faith?
The ultimate debt, divorce. I went through a divorce, and as I went through that divorce, my entire perspective changed. There were career factors that were involved in that, but it was also a irreconcilable difference in how we were raising our kids. In a lot of ways, some of that was faith-based. We were doing what we felt we should be doing, but it just wasn't working for her, for the kids. There were just some challenges associated with that. And when you get divorced, you have a lot of time for introspection. And then my career at that point was pulling me away. So I'm again wrestling with this protection provision element. Yeah. But I'm on the road now, almost 3 out of 4 weeks of the month, almost 5 days a week. Simply because I'm providing. I'm on track. I'm sure we'll get into the career in a little bit more, but I'm on this trajectory to run a very large business unit. All the while I'm struggling at home. We're just not on the same page. We're not aligned at all in any aspect of our lives. And that's really when the switch went off. Now, I would say it was a dimmer switch. It was the light was there. It was just up to me to start thinking through and looking at it and wanting to increase the intensity of it.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I was blessed enough. I had somebody come up to me because I was kind of on a promotion path. And he came up to me and said, "You have young kids, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Don't travel." He's like, "I don't care about the money." He's like, "Yeah, you can make a ton of money." He's like, "But you can't get this stuff back." So I had somebody who actually invested in me. He's like, "Look, there'll be time. If you want to make your money later, do it after your kids are at the certain point." And I was like, "Oh, okay." I talked to my wife about it. And I was like, and I look back and I took that advice. So I like stayed low key kind of doing it. But I look back and I'm like, thank God, right? Like if I didn't have somebody tell me that, I would have taken a job that traveled me 5 days a week, like you were saying. And everybody I know that has that has difficulties. Like, how do you not, right? Like you look at firefighters and police officers, the people who have those long shifts, they also have pretty hard family lives, you know, because you have to be there, you know? And so I've always thanked God that somebody invested that piece into me because I've seen, and like from your example, it's a hard lesson, you know?
It really is. It really is because you get into that as dads, we tend to orient ourselves towards making sure that the family's provided for.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the reasons I'm here is that I went through a number of restructurings, and right before I took this role, my company came back to me and said, "We need you to shift territories." And the short version is I was going to be on the road 80% of the time to maintain where we were financially. And this was right before COVID. Mm-hmm. So I just knew that there was going to be more and more challenges associated with that. And yeah, we'll get into that, I'm sure, in a little bit longer.
Yeah, we'll kind of get into it, because I mean, like, that's the golden hook, right? Like, you get this money and then it's hard to step back, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially when you're providing a certain level of life for your family. And then you're like, hey, I'm going to not make that money so that I can be at home. Mm-hmm. We know in our heart of hearts that our kids want us more than they want the things in their house. They don't know that. And we have trouble seeing that and believing it, you know, because they're, you know, kids are kids. You know, they're the most egocentric people on earth. They just are, you know, they'll get there. But at the time, they think the thing that they have, the toy, is the most important. And so we want to provide that stuff to them. And so you do, they get you with that golden hook and you just, they pull you away. So what was it that you were, you said you were heading towards managing a big business unit. Mm-hmm. What were you doing? Like, what was your profession?
So I worked with lawyers. I worked with the largest law firms across the country. They call it the American Lawyer 200. It's the listing based on the number of attorneys and amount of revenue. So I just grew up in the business, 30 years of working in operational, technology, sales, solutions roles. And I had just gone from managing local law firms here. And when I say managing local law firms, never practiced law.
Right.
I'm not a lawyer.
Got it.
But I helped with all of the business functions. Mm-hmm. Very similar to church. I was a second chair leader that would guide law firms, their administrative teams, mm-hmm. into how best to run their businesses. Because while lawyers can guide the largest corporations, the largest government entities... Yeah.
They don't know anything about managing their
own. They don't manage themselves well.
Yeah.
And their structure is everybody's an owner. Mm-hmm. So you have this infighting, you have these challenges when it comes to internally, they have their own little book of business, but then they have to work together to share resources. That's an ultimate challenge for people that are trained to win, trained to argue.
Right.
And are typically the smartest people in the room. So I would go in and help them understand what they did. So, you know, at the pinnacle of my career, I was leading a technology team that would put in technology stacks, put people around those technologies, and help law firms, whether it's with their billing or their discovery processes, trial presentation, finding the data and information they needed to win that particular legal transaction. So that was my role, and that put me on the road. There was 1 week I was in all four time zones presenting. My gift in that role was translation. I was able to take something that was technology driven, that had financial benefits, and go in and share with administrators, managing partners, this was the business impact.
Right.
This would be, we'd be meeting with them for 50 minutes, and it would come down to 1 or 2 minutes of share with us why, do the closing argument.
Yeah.
I was the guy that typically did the closing argument.
Okay.
This is what we're providing here. This is how the technology is going to impact your operation. This is the financial elements of it. And these are your desired business outcomes.
Yeah. What was it like working with the top 200 lawyers in the country? Like, I mean, that would have been, like you said, they were trained to negotiate and wicked smart. So, I mean, was it hard? Or?
Oh, it was really hard, but it was fun.
Really?
It was fun because at the end of the day, it probably leads to me wanting to be a second chair leader. These are all type A, very driven by ego. To me, it didn't matter if we won or lost. It mattered to me, did I convince them of something? I was not in a point where I really wanted the business deal. What I found is when I really wanted a business deal, I lost focus. Mm-hmm. It was, how do I help them achieve a certain outcome? And how do I convince them of that? So it became kind of gamification for me. If I can convince a lawyer that this is the right solution for them, that's pretty impactful.
Yeah.
Because they spend most of their time being cynical and doubtful and skeptical, and so it was always just it was an interesting dynamic for me.
How? Because I imagine, so you're the closer and you're dealing with super smart people who are challenging you. You're working to convince them. How are you good with confrontation?
I'm not bad with it.
Really? Okay. So, because I'm just sitting there thinking, because I'm terrible with confrontation, right? Like, and it would be hard for me to enter into a room and go blow for blow without internalizing some aspect of the conversation or the conflict. Like, how, I'm sure they were, when they're coming in hot, right? Like, how were you handling that? Did afterwards, did you have to process? Did you have to decompress? Did you have to do, or was it just that, did you just have that mindset to where it's like, hey, I did my job, and if I did my job well, then the results are the results?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I always dealt with objections extremely well. There was one of the largest law firms in New York City. We come in, and I'm prepped for a COO that is just very hostile. He comes in. He's very abrupt. He tells people, we're not doing this. He's rude. He's demeaning. So here comes a guy from Phoenix, which to him, the world is doesn't exist outside the I-95 corridor. There are six of us, only one of him. So it's that classic, we're overmatching him. And I get, they have me start off. And I'm sharing with him this solution where he wants to do this technology stack, but it's 10 times larger than anything that we'd done before. So we had recently done it about 6 months ago in a location in Kansas City. So here's Phoenix guy sharing a Kansas City solution to Manhattan guy. He listens for about 45 seconds, looks at the document that we've given him, and he goes, wait a minute. You're giving me a case study from the Midwest. And then he chucks the proposal at me. Now, my six colleagues are just looking at me, wondering how I'm going to respond. And he goes, why does this mean something to me? And I basically said, well, they made a $1.5 million mistake. You're 10 to 15 times larger than they are. You are about to make a $12 to $15 million mistake. You have the recipe for making that mistake. We have the recipe for you to avoid it. Why? We just did it over here. And he goes, well, why should I listen to you? And I just looked at him, and my colleagues are there, and I said, you don't have to. You really don't have to. We can leave and you can go down this road, but I am fairly certain this team here can help provide it. If you spent some time looking at it, you'll probably see, because we talked to your technology team about it, you're about to make this mistake. And it's up to you. You can listen for a few more minutes. I can try to convince you, or we can end it. And my boss is sitting right there and he's like, what? Don't end this meeting. Don't end this meeting. The short version is he looked at me and he goes, okay, I'll listen a little bit more. And he just kept giving me a couple of more minutes. And suddenly now we're in an interactive conversation. We won the deal after all of that was said and done. We didn't win it that day, but we won it later on. But it was just, it's interesting that, you know, I actually thrive in that type of piece or that type of conversation. I just have a piece about me.
I was just about to ask, did you have this same disposition in that conversation, or were you, you know, equally matching energy, or?
I'm a competitive guy. So when I feel like I'm about to lose, I throw the script away. I throw the game plan away, and I just try to put a little bit more time on the clock. I just have that mindset of just keep swimming. Just keep punching, if you will. And that's just kind of how I tend to do things. I am actually better when I have those objections in front of me than when things are going well.
And that's super interesting. Where do you think that confidence to do that comes from? Right? Because not everybody can counterpunch or like you said, like throw the script away and just roll. Like, you have to be confident in your material, right? But also have an inner confidence that you can handle this, especially with somebody who is hostile, right? Because we don't, that level of hostility isn't a normal everyday interaction.
So I just enjoy the competition side of things. I love to win, but I'm okay if I've competed well and I lose. I'm more than willing to give credit to a better athlete, a better competitor. I know I'm never going to win everything.
Yeah.
And I think that was actually part of that spiritual journey. After about age 45, I just had a much stronger calmness about me. Mm-hmm. I realized how much I was blessed. I realized that I was starting to make a shift of not chasing a lifestyle anymore and really just seeking to be more of a maybe a problem solver, more of a contributor, more of a teammate. I think that was part of it, is that there started to just be a shift in me as I was pursuing, you know, at that time I was still trying to pursue a particular career. I wanted to run a particular business unit. And I realized I had to do that through people. Mm-hmm. I had to do that not only through my teammates, but through my client base. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I also learned is that in my environment, it was a hard sell oftentimes. Mm. And I uncovered somehow that I have a kind of a consultant heart, a consultant mindset, and that problems are just part of everyday life. And the reality of it is those are gifts from God. Trials are how we get strengthened, how mm-hmm. we have resilience. That's what I was learning at that point in time. Yeah. I just didn't know where my resilience was from.
Right.
It was really, I was thinking it was my internal strength, but it was really Him working in my heart. And that was just starting the beginning of that journey that's really been going on for the last decade.
That's interesting. How has the shift from, has the competition gone away? Like, or are you still as competitive? Like, how has that changed?
Oh, I'm still as competitive.
Because I was going to say, how do you switch into, because this is a challenge I get a lot, right? Because like I have nephews who are trying to compete in baseball and things like that. And I'm like, look, guys, I get the competitive wanting to win everything. But I was like, there's a level which you got to switch to a growth mindset because, for example, in baseball, right, the best hitters fail 70% of the time, mm-hmm. right? So, like, there's a lot of – you can't look at it in a win-loss. You have to look at it in a, did I do my job? Did I execute? Did I grow? Did I get better? And you're constantly analyzing and growing. But you still got to want to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I've received the challenge, like, how do you go into a growth mindset – but still want to win with not just being, well, I lost, that's okay. You know, because all of us who are competitive will never say it's okay that we lose, right? Like my girls, I'm trying to teach my girls and they're like, but I lost. I'd be like, I don't care if you lost. I want you to want to win. And so like, it's really hard to communicate how to be growth focused, but still driven and want to win.
Mm-hmm.
Like how did you come to that place or reconcile those two things?
I lost the thing I was chasing.
Hmm.
So I was in this consulting role. I was in line to run our business unit that was dedicated to legal. So I was going to, they had named me as the designated person to run it in very private settings. I was on track for that. It was a $115 million unit. Mm. And so they were grooming me. They were starting to have those conversations with me. I was really excited because for the very first time, they had me, it was part of a venture capital campaign. Had no idea the company was about to be sold and lifted and shifted. So they had me sign an NDA. They're having me think through what does this actual vertical look like? What does it mean to manage that vertical in this new venture capital environment? And so I was extremely excited, felt that I was now part of an inner circle. I was going to have mm-hmm. some direction. And I remember the morning of January 3rd. It was a day in which I received a message I typically took from the Monday before Christmas to the first working day in January off.
Okay, yep.
So I had been off the grid, was checking just a few emails, but on January 2nd, I got an email, an invite for a 4 a.m. conference call, Phoenix Sun.
Hmm.
And that's when they informed me that I had 24 hours to decide if I wanted to stay with the company, My team had been disbanded, and they certain people had been moved into certain roles. I would be given a strategic sales role, overseeing simply myself. I had 24 hours to decide that. And if I was going to do that, I needed to let go, or I needed to inform two of my teammates that they were being dismissed. They were being laid off. That was shocking.
Yeah.
So I'm supposed to be running a business unit, and or designated to run a business unit. And now I'm not informed of any decisions around my little team, my team of eight, let alone the entire 500-person operation that would have been reporting to me. And, you know, for me, the shocking part was I had no involvement in placing my team, and I had no involvement in who was going to be let go. They were letting go my my second and fourth best performer out of the team of 10 with no insight from me on it. So that started a 3-year cycle with that particular organization where I was in different roles all the time. I, for the very first time, was laid off. I chose to keep that role, but a year and a half later, I was laid off. Now, I was picked back up in a different role 48 hours later. They were restructuring. They had everybody reapply the role. Then another 8 months later, I was laid off again. I was picked up 24 hours later. But it was just, I went from this thought process of I'm going to run this to I'm nothing more than a very small piece of this organization.
You're just pulling at scraps right. that they'll let you have every 6 months.
But you asked about the competitive side.
Yeah.
So most people would see that as losing in their career, losing in this.
That's how I would have internalized it. Yeah.
For some reason, again, I didn't know what was happening in my mind and in my heart, but I just, it was just, okay, I'll just deal with this. This isn't my identity anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time I realized I wasn't going to run that business unit anymore, it started to be, okay, what do we need to do for the family? What do we need to keep us going? What makes the most sense? And that was the shift, is my identity started to think through not a role, not a career, but what is in the best interest of our family. And I started to realize that my identity and my status wasn't wrapped up in that role. And that was a 3-year journey because it was just different changes and different things and different managers, different territories, different law firms that I was dealing with. And the game was different for me. It was, I would say this way, there was the career game. But I was not as interested in it anymore. I was more interested in something over here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like sometimes when we get started off, we have the old American idea of like you're going to stay with the company forever, right? So you have this sense of loyalty. But then the first time you're fired or laid off, it just disillusions that, right? And so then you sit back and you go, well, what am I loyal to? Like if I'm loyal to them, they're clearly not loyal to me because like I've been putting it in and they didn't care. Like I'm just a number and a dollar sign to them, right? And so then you start looking back, you're like, well, where's my loyalty, my forever loyalty? The stuff that if I put in there, it's never going to get lost, right? Yeah. And so then you look at like your family, your kids, your extended family, all these things. You'd be like, if I invest there, like they'll never fire me, right? They can't. So right. Let alone like there's no investment that gets lost there. And so, yeah, you kind of reassess. That's how for me, that's how it was, right? Like I was looking at the loyalties because I looked up and said, yeah, they don't have – and my dad being a construction guy has kind of taught me this too. But he's like, don't give them your loyalties. Like they don't care. They'll give you a pink slip in the morning because that's how construction was, right? They would just show up and just pass out pink slips and you were done, you know. And then you go to the office and you try to get a different job somewhere else. And so I was like, yeah, right. But I had some good managers and stuff. But then looking up, things change so often. You're like, they don't care about me as a person. They don't care about my family. They don't care whether I eat or not. Like they got to make their money.
Yeah, it's exactly that was exactly the case for the first 21 years. So mm-hmm. to your point, I was with a company for 25 years. The first 21 were fantastic. It was at that 22 year mark that that last 3 years I had 7 roles. I had 14 managers. At one point I had 4 managers in 6 months. I had multiple territories, but the expectations never changed. Mm-hmm. The quotas never changed. The expectation has shifted into a pay for consulting piece never changed. So 22 years, I should say, and then 3 years. And I'm sitting there going, well, that time frame was defined by those last 3 years. Mm-hmm. So then I struck out and built my own consulting firm.
Oh, did you really?
I did. And that was actually probably the best thing I had ever done. We had no money. We had no capital. We had no clients. But I learned more in that 2.5 years than any other time in my life. And I think that's really was the key, is that I figured out the game needed to look different for me. So I was now going to build what the game would look like. I was going to build the game board, and I was going to use the pieces. And it was an interesting piece to build something from the ground up, to for the very first time have my own vision, my own mission of what something was, with 2 other partners, to build a communication mechanism to clients, to hunt and peck for every single client, to humbly walk in front of somebody and say, hey, we'll do this for almost cost because we just simply need a first client. That was a fascinating, fascinating time. Learn more about myself, learn more about my faith, learn more about God's provision, because there were times I didn't know when the next paycheck was coming. So we did that for 2.5 years. That's really where I think the shift in my identity went. But we were out of money. Even though we had started to get some clients, we were out of money. We were actually down to our last $700 before we were getting into our emergency fund.
Oh, wow.
And I had been in a conversation with a competitor to my previous company, and they offered me the job of my dreams. So I thought.
Yeah.
It was to build the roadmap for what law firm operations would look like. So I did that and went into that role. And 18 months later, that role was disbanded, and I was back in that back and forth again. And so, but by that time, something had fundamentally shifted in me. That's where I found faith in the marketplace, because as I was working with that company, one of the pivotal leaders that I worked side by side with, we would actually pray before meetings. We would actually talk about our faith. That permeated other sales and technology and consulting executives within that company. I started to see we would have hallway conversations about our faith. We would pray about a particular deal. Now I don't feel like praying for a deal is a good thing.
Sure, sure.
But we would sit there and we would think through, okay, can we discern what a client's looking for and all of that sort of thing. So it became another piece to this faith journey. You know, the consulting piece was my identity is no longer in a role, but now I'm at this other company and faith can be part of this. It can actually intersect. Now it might look, it might be in a hallway. It might be very private amongst a small group of believers, but it does exist.
Yeah.
And more importantly, can it work within the context of business?
Yeah.
So that was a very interesting time in that journey too.
Yeah, because like I just had this conversation with my boss not too long ago, and they're like, we want you to show up as your authentic self. I was like, no, you don't. No, you don't. Like, I'm a fairly conservative Christian. You don't want me to show up as my authentic self and speak my mind freely. Like, that's not actually what you want. You want me to show up like you. You want me to look like you because you've told me to dress like you. You want me to talk like you because you've told me I'm not allowed to speak the way that I speak because I'm a little bit country, you know, like from my dad and everything. And I was like, you don't actually want this. So in that corporate world, you're right. Like, it's hard because you almost have to repress a piece of yourself. And then going off on your own, you're like, no, I can let it out. Like, I can be truly me. and go from there. But I think one of the things that seems really interesting listening to your story is just how you went 20 years with a solid foundation. And there's another golden hook in comfort and consistency. And then it seems like after that point, like you didn't have any comfort or consistency. Like the ground was always shifting mm-hmm. underneath you going forward. And yeah, that I just, cause that seems crazy to me. Like how do you not walk on faith? You know, because like that's hard. I can't even imagine because I like looking at my job, I'm like, man, I need that. We've made a lot of our decisions about job security, right? Being able to plan on what you can do. And so, you know, like how do you be a dad or any of these things, you know, like those mindsets that we have as providers when there's not like that job security? Like how do you do that?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I always felt as though I was secure in a role because I was always picked up right after they would restructure, or I was always a candidate for another role. The territory shifted, the objectives shifted, but I just kind of went with the flow with it. I had an inner peace with those types of things. So, you know, your analogy, I'm a runner. I used to road run. And I loved road running because it was predictable. It was mm-hmm. easy. It was lighted. I knew where the path was. About 3 years ago, I took up trail running. And I loved it. Why? Because it wasn't predictable.
Right.
I had to think. I had to look. I had to trust that my footing was solid every step of the way. Where 20 years, 25 years with one organization then shifted to now I wasn't stable. I was never going to advance the way I had hoped to. Mm-hmm. But I was comfortable with that. I had trained myself to think through. It was okay to be unstable. Now, there was a reason why it was okay to be unstable, and that was my faith. But I hadn't put those pieces together.
Right.
It wasn't until I really started to trail run and do more hiking and have that instability that I really realized that it was all about thinking through and trusting that step and that foundation mm-hmm. it was right there underfoot.
I think that's a huge faith statement. Yeah, like I'm listening to it and it's just the idea, the picture that pops up in my brain is you know, like just being able to kind of drive your stake in the ground and then let the world come and go, but you're stable. You know, like we have all the biblical analogies of a pillar or of a corner, like those things that are just, they're steadfast, even though everything around it is not. It's mm-hmm. constantly changing. And, you know, that I think that's interesting that you got to live that out, you know, and that's the conclusion there. Because, I mean, that's a lot. Like, because of that instability, you think it's just your finances, but everything in your life, we're not, as men, I think we kind of compartmentalize, or I should speak for myself. I compartmentalize a lot. And so I have my job self, I have my husband self, I have my dad self, and they're generally not different people, but like they're in these nice little pockets that are different in my brain. But that's not actually how it works. You know, we're an intertwined, tangled web. And so something in the job pulls on the string, shakes the web, and it shakes the family and it shakes the faith line. And so like everything is rocking. There is no, you can't have one compartment stable and another one unstable. They interact. And so having that instability in your job life can absolutely challenge or move forward into faith or family or any of those things like that.